How do you stop a currency fight from becoming a trade war?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke. It is the Midday Update from Marketplace.org on this Columbus Day, Monday, October 11th. Tension over global currencies tops our podcast today, and we welcome Jane DeRista with the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Hi, Jane.
Hi, good morning. Thank you.
So the International Monetary Fund just met over the weekend. They talked about this global edginess over competing currencies. Very simply, Jane, what's the issue?
Well, the issue is that the price of a currency, how much it takes you to buy another currency, is very important. It affects the price of the goods you try to sell in the market. And if your currency is overvalued, it means that you're not going to sell as many goods at home. And what that means for the United States, as it has meant for a long time, is that you've got to reduce wages and cut jobs. And that's something that we have experienced. Other countries are very concerned now because it is affecting them as well. And these are countries that depend upon exports for growth, what we call export-led growth. And we know, of course, China and Japan and Germany and Brazil and others are very dependent on this form of growth.
So everybody wants to export. How do you solve that dilemma?
Well, and so the United States ends up being the buyer of last resort, as we have been for many years now, amassing this huge trade deficit, which we know is unbalancing the world and we are concerned about. The great threat here is the tensions are mounting. The currencies, people are trying to get their currency down, and that is a competitive situation. It really doesn't help anybody. In the end, what we have to do is go to the root of the problem, not slap tariffs on, not exacerbate the problem, not create additional tensions, but figure out how can we create a system where we don't have a key currency that always has to be the buyer of last resort, and nobody else, of course, except the U.S. wants to do this.
Jane, we're going to have to keep following that. Thanks for putting that in a nutshell for us this morning. Jane DeRista, Political Economy Research Institute at UMass. Thank you.
Thank you.
The Nobel Prize for Economics was announced this morning, and with that, reporter Janet Babin is with us. Hi, Janet.
Hi, Bill.
And the winner is?
Well, the winners are Peter Diamond, Dale Mortensen, and Christopher Passiridis. They won for developing theories that help explain how economic policies can affect unemployment. Their work shows, among other things, why lots of people remain unemployed even when there are plenty of job openings to be had.
Yes, unemployment. I've heard about this topic.
Mm-hmm.
What can you tell us about the winners?
Well, Diamond's an economist at MIT, and President Obama actually nominated him to become a member of the Federal Reserve, but the Senate failed to approve his nomination before lawmakers left to campaign for midterms. Mortensen's at Northwestern University. His research focuses on labor economics, and Passiridis is a professor at the London School of Economics.
And Janet, was this a surprise victory?
Well, Bill, Mortensen had been thought by some to be a front-runner for this prize. Americans tend to do well in the economics department. Since the Economy Prize was first awarded back in 1969, more than 40 Americans have received it.
Well, Americans have not exactly dominated the Nobels overall this year.
No, they haven't. If you're keeping track this Columbus Day, the U.S. has now won three Nobels this year. American Richard Hack, Richard Heck, shared the Nobel Prize in Chemistry with Japanese researchers.
That's reporter Janet Babin joining us live. Janet, thank you for that.
You're welcome, Bill.
Remember when Wall Street firms defended their big bonuses by saying, we have to pay these people a lot if we want to attract top talent? Today's Wall Street Journal reports some of the giant signing bonuses haven't worked out so well lately. Joining us live from New York is Aaron Lucchetti. Aaron, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
Securities firms like Wells Fargo, Morgan Stanley, Bank of America, and others paid these six- and seven-figure bonuses to lure brokers away from rival companies. Why haven't they worked out?
Well, the markets have been tough. It's a very competitive world for brokers right now, and with markets not soaring like they used to, it's difficult for brokers to make money, and it's even more difficult for the firms to make money off brokers when they've given these big guaranteed bonuses.
Should that make me think any differently about these firms' argument that they have to pay huge bonuses to keep effective top talent?
you know, it's really a variation on that theme. And they've said that for, you know, years about traders, and they've said that about investment bankers. But it's also true of brokers. Brokers can jump across the street, go from UBS to Wells Fargo or vice versa. And so the firms really want to keep those brokers. The broker is one of the more stable sources of revenues for these companies, especially in a world where trading is up and down and is facing heavier regulation.
That's right. The brokerage business, that was supposed to be the stable part of the business.
Right. It's still stable, but it's just less profitable for the firms when you pay, you know, 30, 40, 50% of all the revenues to the brokers. The broker's argument, of course, is, hey, we're the ones that are talking to clients. They trust me, not necessarily the firm, especially after what's happened with the financial crisis. So I'm pretty valuable here.
And just a few more seconds, Aaron, you write that some of these firms are going to arbitration and getting these bonuses back. Is that like a mortgage borrower reneging on their promise to pay back the loan?
It's a great argument. The firms say, look, you know, you signed the contract, you have to live by it. You're in a business of trust and in a business where people are supposed to value your words. So to go back on a contract is pretty difficult.
Wall Street Journal reporter Aaron Lucchetti joining us live. Thanks a lot.
Good to be here. Thank you.
You might find some bargains today, Columbus Day sales and all. And retailers also hope you're doing your Christmas shopping. They're hopeful but not quite desperate, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genza reports.
Holiday promotions started earlier than ever this year with some Christmas in July sales, but consumers are still cautious, and that's affecting prices. Frank Badillo is senior economist at Cantor Retail.
Prices are dropping at a 2 to 3% rate from a year ago.
That's nice, but I'm from a family of bargain hunters. For my husband, 20% off is an insult. We're waiting for those 75% off sales stores had 2 years ago. Marshall Cohen is the chief retail analyst at NPD Group. He says we're out of luck. Retailers are lowering prices just enough to lure in consumers. No big discount.
Look for it to be more about 30 to 40% off. And that seems to be the number that consumers are responding to.
Plus, Cohen says stores didn't order as much merchandise this year, so they won't have to slash prices to unload piles of unsold stuff. Depressed in Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Monday, October 11th. I'm Bill Radke. For the latest look at the markets, go to the numbers at marketplace.org. The global perspective now, what's happening in business and economics around the world. The Russian military has come up with an inventive way to trick the enemy and save money at the same time. Inflatable weapons. These decoys look just like real armaments, and they're easy to transport. They're quick to deploy. The BBC's Steve Rosenberg reports for Marketplace on this move to blow up Russia's armed forces.
On the edge of Moscow, two men carry a black duffel bag into a field and then drop it on the ground. When they open the bag, they take out a large sheet of plastic. It looks like a tent or a tarpaulin. In fact, it's the Russian army's latest strategic weapon. It doesn't need ammunition, just air. On goes the pump, in goes the air, and the plastic sheet begins to rise and take shape. A turret appears. Then out pops a long plastic gun barrel. This is an inflatable Russian tank. When the men pump up their next piece of plastic, this one expands into an S-300 rocket launcher, complete with giant truck and inflatable rockets, a cross between a ballistic missile and a bouncy castle. There are also inflatable MiG fighter jets, even inflatable Russian radar stations. These state-of-the-art standards are among the most advanced military decoys in the world. What they lack in firepower, they make up for in flexibility. They're light and can be deployed quickly to deceive the enemy. They're also very realistic and made of a special material that tricks enemy radar and thermal imaging systems into thinking they're real weapons. Not only do they look real, they're cost-effective. The decoys are 100 times cheaper than the real thing, which means that Russia will save a lot of money by blowing up its own weapons.
The BBC's Steve Rosenberg reporting from Moscow for Marketplace. A British theatre company hopes audiences will pay for the privilege of falling asleep. The new show is called Lullaby. You arrive at the theatre in central London in your PJs, and you get a bedtime story and soothing music, followed 8 hours later by a wake-up call, shower, and breakfast. Tickets are $66, which the theatre company points out is competitive with, say, the Holiday Inn. You're listening to the Midday Update for Monday, October 11th. I'm Bill Radke. For the latest look at the markets, you go to the numbers at marketplace.org. Microsoft may still be king of the PC, but it is way behind in the smartphone game. And today, the company hopes to change that with the release of its Windows 7 operating system for mobile devices. Marketplace's John Dimsdale has more.
Smartphone sales are growing at a 30% clip. But Microsoft's share of the software that operates phones has fallen by half to just 5%. To try to take back the market from Google's Android and Apple's iPhone, Microsoft today will unveil a group of smartphones that run on Windows Phone 7. Software analyst Rob Enderle says for WP7 to be successful, it'll have to look stunning and work well.
It has to stand out as being something that's different and desirable, and it certainly has to show up on attractive hardware and on carriers that are beyond AT&T.
That won't be the case at first, but analysts expect the software will make downloading and watching videos and movies on phones easier. Still, Microsoft is so far behind the competition that some analysts think it might be better for Microsoft to just buy a more successful phone company, like maybe the one that makes BlackBerry. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
We know the internet has hurt newspapers and the postal service and flea markets. You would think you could add to that list the phone book. I mean, why do we need this gigantic printed tree-killing compendium? Yet the telephone directory hangs on. I'm joined now by the author of a new book called The Phone Book, The Curious History of the Book That Everyone Uses But No One Reads. Ammon Shea, welcome to Marketplace.
Hi, thanks for having me.
If no one reads it, why does the phone book still land with a thud on my driveway?
Well, there are several reasons for that. The first is that everybody likes to say that they don't want the phone book, but when you actually try to take it away from them, there's a good amount of protestation on their parts. Particularly people who are not necessarily conversant with the internet, say people of a certain age, the elderly, they tend to become a little discomfited when you tell them you're going to take their telephone books away.
And what's the next reason the phone book survives?
Well, for Yellow Pages particularly, because they're great business. It's a wonderful profit machine. And in 1996, Congress passed the Telecommunications Bill, which was ostensibly aimed at fostering competition. And there was a little tiny bit of it that said basically anybody that wants to can now print a Yellow Pages. They just need to get the telephone numbers and you can go ahead.
That explains why there are so many more now than when I was a kid.
They've exploded.
It sounds like you love the phone book, Ammon, but it is doomed, right?
Well, one would think it's doomed. However, I think innate human laziness probably has more to do with its survival than anything else. For instance, in Norway, which is considerably more environmentally conscious than we are here, they've had an opt-out policy in place for years, meaning if you don't want a telephone book, just call us and we won't send you one. And approximately 7% of the population takes the time to pick up the phone and say, don't send me a telephone book. Conversely, if you have an opt-in policy saying you only get a telephone book if you ask for one, in the United States, polls have found that approximately 2% of the population will say, yes, I want a telephone book. So until they get around to changing the laws saying you don't need to have a telephone book and decide whether they're going to do an opt-in or an opt-out, I think the book is pretty much going to stick with us.
It's called The Phone Book, The Curious History of the Book That Everyone Uses But No One Reads. Ammon Shea, thank you.
Well, thanks very much.
And finally, some fans of the rock group Weezer want to pay the band to break up. They don't think Weezer has made any good music since their 1996 album Pinkerton. and they're tired of being disappointed. So the fans are trying to raise $10 million they can use to bribe Weezer to stop releasing records. How does Weezer feel about the criticism? They don't seem to care. The drummer says, you know, if they can make it $20 million, we'll do the deluxe breakup. In Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.